This is In Deep with Angie Coiro. I am the aforementioned Angie Coiro. Our show crew is thrilled to add KALW to our roster of stations. Now, for me, this is a homecoming. KALW was the first California radio station I worked at when I moved here in the 80s. So I'm an import, but In Deep is homegrown. Born in a Berkeley studio, the show is now recorded live every week at Kepler's Books in Menlo Park. It's every Wednesday at noon, and seats are free if you'd like to join us. What's it about? We work to bring you one full hour on one intriguing topic. We draw guests from all walks of American news and culture. We're using this first hour to give you a taste of In Deep. These are excerpts from some of our best shows in 2015. We had a surprisingly funny conversation about revisiting Vietnam and the protest era. After that, you'll hear about two musical theater pieces that really couldn't be any more different. First up, our biggest 2015 audience by far streamed into Kepler's to hear Stanford Dean and mother of two, Julie Lithcott-Hames. She wore both of those hats to produce her book, How to Raise an Adult. Here are some highlights from our conversation. As we settle into this hour, we're going to put a couple of terms right out there on the table, and yes, they're the more demeaning ones. Helicopter parent, tiger mom, and for the kids, special snowflake. Now, these phrases were born out of a relatively new phenomenon, anxious, driven, goal-focused parents raising anxious, maybe a little less driven, maybe not, sometimes goal-resenting children. And shaping a kid for the right schools now starts in the womb. The only excellent report card has all A's. There are 5 or maybe 10 universities that are the only acceptable outcome of the application process. Any other one is a disappointment. All along the way, parents are hovering. They have their hearts in their throats if the kid goes out of sight for 30 minutes. They have internet and smartphones, so they are pinging the teachers, the kids, even the military leaders, if they've gone to West Point, and the kids' bosses, if they work in a bank. Julie Lithcott-Hames knows this story from both sides. She spent more than 10 years advising undergraduates as the dean of freshmen at a small university down the street from here, Stanford. She's the mother of two children immersed in the phenomenon we'll be talking about today, and she has a book out on the topic, How to Raise an Adult, Break Free of the Overparenting Trap, and Prepare Your Kid for Success. Julie, welcome to the show. What is an adult?
Boy, what is an adult? Well, I think that's a $64,000 question. I have to say, when I was dean of freshmen at Stanford, I found myself feeling as if more and more of my students each year weren't quite adult. But I'll confess, I had no idea what I meant by that. There was a sense that something was missing. It took me years to figure out what it was. It's the wherewithal to be an adult, okay? It's the ability to fend for oneself, and fend doesn't mean text or call your mom or dad, okay? So, as I like to say, we're mammals with clothing and a cell phone, but we're mammals nevertheless. And our job, as with any mammal, is to raise our offspring to independence. However, as humans, you know, there's a lot that these days gets in the way of that. So our job is to put ourselves out of a job and raise an adult who can earn money to pay for shelter and food and clothing, clean up after themselves. More importantly, have a sense of self, a sense of I've got this, a sense of I can figure that out, a sense of how to be kind and gracious with other human beings. I mean, that's sort of a successful adult. You know, someone with those skills is going
to
make it.
You have so many anecdotes in the book to illustrate all your points. And it struck me a couple of times that if you were to extract that anecdote out of this context, you'd think you were dealing with less than intelligent kids. There's the kid who has his boxes brought to college, the university. They are downstairs, and they stay downstairs because he doesn't know how to ask for help to get the boxes up to his dorm room. So how does someone who has gone through the best of high schools, gone through the best of tutoring, gone through the best of everything, show up at university and not know how to take his boxes upstairs?
Because mom or dad have done the planning of the path, and they've hovered and been alongside to help ensure the path is followed. They've removed obstacles from the path. Essentially, they've deprived that kid of thinking, being, and doing for themselves. So however accomplished they are in a resume and transcript sense, they don't know how to ask a stranger to help with boxes. That's a parenting fail, in my view. Parents are doing too much. They're actually focusing on the wrong definition of success. You know, you want to know your kid can make breakfast. You want to know your kid can wake up to an alarm. You want to know your kid feels a sense of responsibility to get him or herself to high school if they've slept through the alarm. Not that you will always be there to drive them, or what is happening today, raise your hand if you've heard it, I'll just send them by Uber or Lyft. It's true. Okay? People are doing this. Right? And we titter and it's so funny, but people are doing this. It's horrible. It's breeding in them this sense. I mean, unless you intend to raise your kid in the luxury class, and I know there are some people in this room who maybe are planning to raise their kid, capable of raising their kid in the luxury class where everything will always be done for them. For the rest of us, Uber is not a solution to getting your kid to high school.
It's interesting you bring up class, because is this phenomenon class wide? Is it
yes.
upper middle?
You know. Yes. Yes. This is where our influence and our affluence are undercutting our kids' chances to survive and thrive out in the real world. This is where kids from poor backgrounds and working class backgrounds have a set of life skills, that grit, that resilience that we all read about but wonder, how do you get that in Palo Alto or Menlo Park or Atherton? Okay, this is where kids from poorer backgrounds, they have a tray in their toolkit their more affluent counterparts don't have. Life has been harder and they've got thicker skin and they've figured it out. And if those kids get a chance at a decent education and a mentor or two, they'll probably leave their more affluent counterparts in the dust.
How did we go from a society where, you know, the kids could be playing Foursquare or dodgeball in the street, car comes along, they get out of the street, the car goes by, mom may not even know where they are, they're out playing, and if they come back, she says, go back outside because she's trying to make dinner. That doesn't happen anymore. What changed?
What changed? You know, I had the same question. So we were noticing on the Stanford campus, what people were noticing on college campuses across the nation in every tier in the late 90s, the appearance of parents. You know, parents weren't just kind of dropping sons and daughters off and going home. Some stayed. More were wanting to be very virtually present in the life of the university, beginning in the late 90s. I'll confess to you, it seemed funny because it was unusual in the late 90s. Boy, I long for those days. Because every year brought more and more parents who were wanting to play a role in the life of their college-age son or daughter, and fewer students who had the wherewithal, that ability to be an adult we talked about in the first question. So what was happening? I was curious, just like you are. I decided to go backwards in time. If 1998 brought the arrival of the first parents with the first set of freshmen, give or take, well, those kids were born in 1980. Who are they? The beginning of the millennial generation. Who raised them? Baby boom. The baby boom, many members of baby boom in the audience. Hi, I'm Gen X myself, but hi. latchkey. Stuck between baby boom and millennial, these two enormous generations. A poor latchkey. All we can do is write books about what's wrong. This is fun. This
I'm
is
glad
really
you
fun.
Like it.
Okay. Are we on radio right now?
No, we will be.
Okay. We will. This is going to be on the radio? Okay, awesome. I'm joking. Of course I knew that. Okay. So the baby boom. What did the baby boom do? They insisted upon their own right to exist as teenagers and young adults. They were fierce advocates for their own point of view back in the day, and they undid fundamental structures and paradigms of American society to great good, okay? They did so much. They transformed so many things. Civil rights, women's movement, Vietnam, fantastic, okay? Question authority was their mantra. They are parents now, and perhaps in part to compensate for what their own parents didn't do, because their own parents were very hands-off and, you know, children are to be seen and not heard, and they wanted to be there for their own kid. They were so interested in their own self-actualization. They were still interested in that on behalf of their own kids. They decided, we'll be very present, we'll be very involved, not realizing that one becomes self-actualized by doing for oneself. So the great, great irony is the baby boom, of all people, have managed to deprive their own kids of the very ability to be oneself that they so championed for themselves. In the mid-80s, early to mid-80s, when they were beginning to raise these millennials, we had the birth of the stranger danger fear, two very well-publicized cases, Eitan Patz in New York, Adam Walsh in Florida, two kids abducted and murdered. Obviously, a horrific tragedy, the most horrific thing we can imagine as parents. Our fear of stranger danger was born. We began seeing kids, missing kids' faces on the backs of milk cartons staring out at us over breakfast, and we thought it was happening everywhere all the time. It wasn't. The people behind the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children began lumping in runaways with custodial disputes, with other types of quote-unquote thrown-away children, meaning their parents don't want them to come back home, and actual cases of stranger abduction, which latest statistics say are happening at the rate of 115 kids a year in a nation with 74 million kids. It's horrific, but we mustn't spend our day and night expecting that it's happening in our town. We must prepare our kids for the streets and the parks and the world, rather than pretend we will always be there to do this. So Stranger Danger was born in the early 80s. Self-esteem movement was born right here in California in the early 80s. Let's applaud kids just for showing up. Trophy, certificate, ribbon, right? The only people benefiting from that are the trophy, certificate, and ribbon manufacturers, okay? All right, the third thing that happened was the playdate was born. Moms were going back to work. Dads weren't exactly staying home with kids. Play had to be sort of arranged. And maybe that was very practical solution, but what it became was parents watching over play, hovering, deciding, here, why don't you play with this? Why don't you do that? And when they weren't getting along, they weren't taking turns. Mom mostly, sometimes dad was there to help the kids work it out. Okay?
Now, where's the link there between seeing your child as very, very vulnerable and wanting to micromanage every single thing that kid is doing?
A child begins extremely vulnerable as an infant helpless in our arms and ends up somehow capable, we hope, of fending for themselves as an 18-year-old, 20-year-old, 25-year-old. I mean, what is the age of adulthood these days? So we have to acknowledge, yeah, they're vulnerable. What do we want to do with a vulnerable person? Empower them. Right? Not be there for them, always doing for them, fostering this sort of eternal helplessness. No, we don't want our kids. There's a guy in my book I quote from Massachusetts, a superintendent called Joe Maruzchek, and he coined the term veal to describe today's young adults. People have said they're like orchids, beautiful, exquisite, but don't survive outside of the greenhouse, or they're like teacups. You know, they're exquisite to look at, but if they chip, they're basically not good enough anymore. He says they're like veal, and they run home in the face of the world's slaughter. I don't want my kids to be veal out in the world. I want them to be warriors. If the world offers a slaughter, I want my kids to stand there like superheroes, you know, and ensure that doesn't happen, not only to themselves, but to anyone else. Okay, so I'm on my soapbox now. I've lost
it. I figured
there's
you'd
a
wind
fourth
down.
Thing. There's a fourth thing. Stranger Danger, Self-Esteem, Playdate. The fourth thing happening in the early 80s was A Nation at Risk was published, a book that said American teenagers weren't faring as well as compared to their international peers academically. We needed to have more testing and teach to the test. So homework, homework, hover, hover, hover around play and school and all this praise, you know, and Stranger Danger. I mean, all of these things were happening to young kids in the early 80s. My goodness, it's amazing they made it out of childhood. They became the first set to bring parents to college campuses in the late 1990s.
If you're just joining us, we are listening to Julie Lithcott-Hames. She's here with us in Menlo Park to talk about how to raise an adult, breaking free of the overparenting trap and prepare your kid for success. When did you learn that some of this applied to you?
What? Angie, it's a personal question. It's not a personal question. I confess to all of this in my book, as Angie knows.
Which I think is marvelous.
I had to. I didn't realize that I was one of those parents. Every year, Stanford has about 1,700 freshmen. Every year, most of them would come with a parent or two for orientation. And we had a big dinner on that first night of orientation for parents, which was designed to communicate, trust your kid has what it takes. You have raised them well. Trust the university is not here to do as little as we can get away with, but as much as we can, possibly to educate your son or daughter, and go home. Those were the three messages. Trust your kid, trust the university, now please leave. And I, you know, got to be a part of that dinner every year. And in 2009, when my own kids were 8 and 10, I came home the next day, and it was dinner time, and I leaned over and began cutting my son's meat. And I thought, oh my God, when do you stop cutting their meat? No, there's no manual that says, when do you let them cross the street? When do you let them do their own homework? When do you let them talk to strangers? Why? Because the vast majority of time spent as they make their way in the world will entail interacting with strangers. This blanket rule, don't talk to strangers, means our kids don't know how to look up and make eye contact and have respectful conversation with strangers to get their needs met. We have to teach our kids the much you know, more delicate task of discerning the few bad strangers from the vast, vast majority of people who would be glad to help them. So I realized that in 2009, and it changed me from this kind of finger-wagging dean. I never actually wagged my finger at Stanford parents, but in my mind, I was wagging my finger like, come on, folks, this is not middle school, it's college. And then I realized I was on track to become a parent who couldn't let go. And it showed me the connection between our day-to-day behaviors as parents and that magical day of hoped-for independence of off to college, and how we have to do work every day along the way. It doesn't magically happen for them that they become independent adults at the stroke of midnight on their 18th birthday or the night before they leave for college.
Well, let's start at the very beginning. If we start from, say, birth to age 5, can you give us an example of how you're going down the wrong track as a parent, or how you can start going down the right track as a parent from the very beginning?
Well, the three types of overparenting are overprotection. The world is scary and unsafe. Have I already said the three types? I don't think so. Okay. The world is scary and unsafe and unpredictable, and therefore I must protect and prevent rather than prepare. That's type one. Type two is the tiger type, the over-directing type. I know best what it takes to succeed. You will follow my lead. You will go to this school, study these things, become this or that profession or career person. The over-directing type. The third type is the concierge. I'll handle it for you. It's the I'll call Uber. I'll get you that ride you need. It's the let me smooth your path. I'll be your personal assistant or your secretary or your handler. Okay. And the what we call helicopter parenting actually falls into some one, two, or three of these types. Okay. So trying to avoid those things from birth to age 5. You know, I think when they're learning to stand and walk is the last time we accept that trying and failing, trying and failing, trying and failing is actually the way you learn, that failure is life's greatest teacher. So we're willing to applaud and watch and so on when they're trying to stand and trying to walk. We have to bring that mentality to age 2 and age 3 and age 4 and 5 and 10 and 12 and 15, okay? We have to remember that they are constantly building skills and we are not meant to constantly do for them, okay? So chores. Kids today don't do chores at anywhere near the rate they used to. And there's this wonderful study, the longest longitudinal study of humans conducted, called the Harvard Grant Study, I believe, conducted of members of the Harvard class of 1930-something, all male, almost all white, but yet they tracked them through the 30s and 40s up to the present if they're still alive. And the conclusions from that study said chores are the number one indicator of success in career, and love slash happiness slash relationships equals success, full stop.
And that's where we're going to pick it up in the next segment.
Excellent.
Oh, you're good at picking up cues. I just looked and she stopped.
And that's where we'll stop for a moment. You can hear our whole conversation with Julie Lithcott-Hames online at indeepradio.com. In just a moment, revisiting Vietnam with a hippie and a yippie. I'm Angie Coiro. This is In Deep.
Must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well, their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know by. Don't you ever ask them why, if they told you you would cry, so just look at them and sigh. You
elders grew high, and so please help them with your need. They see the truth before they can die.
Teach your parents well.
You're listening to In Deep, produced weekly at Kepler's Books in Menlo Park. I'm Angie Coiro. In October, The People Make the Peace debuted on bookshelves. Activist and author Frank Joyce and contributor and Yippie Judy Gumbo were among some 200 Americans who, like so many others, believed the war was unjust and unfairly demonized the people of Vietnam. These 200, though, went further than the average protesters. They took up an invitation from Vietnamese citizens to come to their country and help initiate people-to-people diplomacy and to create a citizens' peace treaty. In 2013, veterans of that international effort returned to Vietnam to reconnect with their counterparts there. Frank and Judy brought us their stories from the streets of Chicago in the 60s to that 2013 reunion. And surprisingly, we had some good laughs. I warned you that we have a lot of backtracking to do to tell people exactly what's what. And I'm sure that one of the words that's going to stick out during our conversation is yippee. And it's so, Judy Gumbo, you were one of the yippies. What was that?
The yippies were a group of young people who wanted to put together hippie counterculture and political activism. And we did so by promoting theatrical events that were at the same time directed at exposing the horrors of the Vietnam War. So, for example, one of our major actions was to levitate the Pentagon. We had a group of people, we surrounded the Pentagon, we chanted out, demons out, and some say they actually saw it rise at least 5 feet off the ground. Another action that we did was to bring the stock exchange, the New York City Stock Exchange, to a halt and a way to satirize corporate greed. And we went up onto the balcony, we threw dollar bills down onto the stockbrokers, who immediately started to stop trading and started to grab at the bills that were coming
down. Kind of missing the point.
Yeah, exactly.
Or making the point.
And the really funny thing is we had about $200 in $1 bills, and we threw that. And then when that was done, we didn't have any more money left, so we started to throw coins. And the stockbrokers got really unhappy and started to boo us. And so those were, I would say, the two of the most important yippie actions. And then the third, of course, was running a pig named Pigasus for president in the summer of 1968. And that became known as the Chicago summer that is pretty well known for. It's what has been called the riots at the Democratic Convention in 68. In fact, later, I think it was the Walker Commission determined that they were, in fact, police riots. But people got beaten and tear gassed. I was certainly among them. And it was actually both an empowering and a horrific experience, because the gas that they used turned out to be CS gas, which was subsequently outlawed for use in Vietnam.
Wow.
And yet they used it at home on demonstrators at home.
You know what's interesting about all this is that I lived in the Midwest at the time. You were on the coast, correct?
I was on the coast, and then I was in Chicago, and then, I mean, I was a traveler. I was in numerous places.
I remember I was not much of a cognizant person at that time, but I had brothers and sisters. And I remember the way it was playing in the Midwest was, oh, these crazy people are trying to elevate the Pentagon. What is that? And I wonder about how you hoped to reach Americans who weren't really paying attention, and how that was going to raise your profile at the same time you were kind of in danger of being looked at as kooks.
We didn't care about being looked at as kooks, because if the media was willing to report on us, and the yippies were very much into the media and into what we in fact called manipulating the media, because remember, it was the days before internet where there was so much information. If we could get ourselves on television or on the radio by these dramatic and theatrical actions, we figured we were doing our job. We actually were influenced by a Canadian philosopher and scholar by the name of Marshall McLuhan.
Yes.
And his theory was the medium is the message. For us, color television was the medium that was the message, because certainly the civil rights movement was on TV, but this was the first time in history that color television was widely enough used that people could watch it. And during the Democratic Convention, Walter Cronkite, who was the main guru of TV at that time, saw the feeds coming in, and he said on live TV, they're beating our children. they're beating our children. Mayor Daley, who was the mayor of Chicago at the time, was so incensed and unhappy about what was going on that he yelled at Senator Abraham Ribicoff, who was a delegate, "You motherfucking Jew, bastard, get your ass out of Chicago." And we know this because at the conspiracy trial, we had a tape of it. It wasn't broadcast, but we had a tape that a lip reader looked at, and that's what she came up with.
Frank, she was affiliated with the Yippies, and she was going from the coast to Chicago.
Right.
What was your, what did you have affiliations?
My start, I am a child of the 60s, and my start was in the civil rights movement. And in my chapter of the book, I tell the story about moving from being a rebel without a cause to being a rebel with a cause was a time when I happened to be driving down the infamous road, 8 Mile Road. Young enough to know who Eminem is, at any rate, may know something about 8 Mile Road because he stars in a great movie about 8 Mile Road. And at that time, this was in 1960, at that time, at the corner of Greenfield and 8 Mile Road, there was a segregated swimming pool in which Negro children, as they would have been known then in polite language, were not allowed to access this pool. There was a picket line there. I saw the picket line. I said, I agree with those people. They're right. I joined the picket line, and that was kind of my baptism of turning, as happened to so many of our contemporaries, young people who were in a sort of rebellious place, but looking for some context and some cause with which to connect that rebellion. So that led me to a lifelong activity, actually, of civil rights action, mostly in the North, based in Detroit. Later, I helped to form an organization called People Against Racism. I participated in the second Selma to Montgomery march in 1965. And it was out of this beginning to understand the dynamics of race and segregation and the history of slavery in the United States that I and many of my contemporaries concluded that the war in Vietnam was a racist war. One, because of the disproportionate casualties being suffered by African Americans and Hispanics, who were being killed and injured at far higher rates than whites were in the war itself. And secondly, we concluded that if Vietnam had been populated by white people, we would never in a million years have brought the firepower, the weaponry, the chemical weapons that were used against the Vietnamese, the Laotians, and the Cambodians to bear.
Your people are all in there doing the same job. Why would there be a racial component to who was dying?
For two reasons. One, who was being drafted was racially disparate. So white people had resources to avoid the draft, resist the draft, et cetera, that were not available to African Americans. And of course, affluent white people had more of those resources than poor white people. And the military has always had a class structure, as we know. I think that's true of every military everywhere, but it's, I think, especially true in the United States. But in addition to that, being from Detroit, knowing a little about the auto industry, having worked in auto factories, if you go to an auto factory today, you will find that there are a disproportionate number of African Americans doing the least desirable jobs in the factory. It's African Americans who work. You can see this in Diego Rivera's famous industry murals in the Detroit Institute of Arts. Who's working in the foundry? Who's working the hottest, dirtiest jobs? That would be African Americans. Same in the military. Who's put in the most dangerous situations of all? That would be African Americans. Was true then. It's still true today.
Let me throw a question at both of you about the history. There was a domino theory that if anything on the planet fell to communism, we were all going to be in danger of falling to communism. So the contention on the part of the U.S. was it was important to the fight against communism that we intervene in the situation between North and South Vietnam. Mm-hmm. The protesters rejected that.
Right.
So what did they see going on there that would refute the idea that it was important to the fight against communism?
Well, Vietnam has a 3,000-year history of resistance to foreign invasion. And we recognized that this is a country that had the right to determine their own destiny. So it wasn't, this was like an ideological excuse for invasion, but it was not consistent with the reality of what we saw the Vietnamese government in the North especially wanting to achieve. You know, communism has been a bugaboo for a long time. It's been a bugaboo here in the United States. And what's interesting to me is, where is it now? You know, if you take a little bit of the long view of history, you say, well, all right, the Soviet Union, no more. Cuba, these last few countries that remain who call themselves communists are not, but yet some of the ideas that go along with communism are something that I think bear looking at. For example, when we were in Vietnam, we visited a factory, and and the way it was organized in terms of the workers, the good salaries that they got, daycare on site, dental clinics, there were a lot of people-friendly programs that are ideologically, if not communist, are at least ideologically socialist. And the conversations that we had, certainly that I had with some of the government officials there, I said to them, what are you trying to achieve? What type of government are you trying to achieve? And they said, we are trying to get to what they called a socialist-oriented market economy. And I think that if you look at the former communist countries today, the ones that are in some ways functional, that is kind of the direction in which they're attempting to go.
Let me pick at that a little bit. If we have a situation where the U.S. was fighting communism, and we have a situation where the protesters were saying, this is not what we're really fighting over there, and then you say that now what we perceive to be dangerous communist countries have all turned to different ways of governing themselves, how do you know they're not different because the U.S. fought communism?
Well, I would answer that in a micro way and in a macro way. One of the things we rejected was, and considered a propaganda point, was that there was a civil war in Vietnam. There was no civil war in Vietnam. The creation of North Vietnam and South Vietnam was an artificial template imposed by the United States at the time of the 1954 Geneva Accords that ended the treaty under which the French colonial government withdrew from Vietnam. And this was an artificial boundary at the 17th parallel. We had an honest-to-God civil war in which the North fought the South. We imposed that notion on Vietnam. But there is no historic cultural difference between the North and the South. That distinction was completely artificial and completely an invention of the United States in the first place. So that's the first problem. From an even bigger picture, one of the points that we argue in the book that we think is so important and why we think this book is so important is the United States is a warrior nation. We have been a warrior nation from 1608 when the first pilgrims landed to this day. We, the default, the norm in the United States, everybody within the sound of my voice who has been alive for even one day in which the United States was not killing somebody in a foreign country somewhere, raise your hand. There are no hands up. And there are no hands up because whether we were fighting the Apache or the Seminoles or protecting the barbarity of the slave trade or protecting the barbarity of our own slave breeding system in the United States or fighting the French or fighting the Spanish or fighting now in Afghanistan, Iraq, all throughout the Middle East, we do war. That's what we as a culture do. First, we decide to have the war, then we make up the reason to justify it. And so we never bought that that was the actual rationale for the war in the first place.
Judy, about 40 seconds.
Yeah, there's one other thing. I believe it was President Eisenhower who identified the military-industrial complex. There's a lot of profit to be made in wars. And if you ask yourself, why were we really fighting, you can't say it wasn't because of the profit. In other words, I'm not defending communist authoritarianism by any stretch of the imagination, but we really have to understand and this is where I guess communism gives us a little insight, we have to understand the economic basis as to why this country is a warrior nation, as Frank said.
Let's start getting into the personal histories that you folks relate in the book, because you were both about 200 people who over time made their way over to Vietnam. It's easier to imagine doing that now because you can go get a visa, hop on a plane, and go. We also didn't have the communication then that we have now, where you can connect with people in another world on an internet and say, I'm going to meet you here. We're going to talk about this. So first, walk me through the logistics. Judy, let's start with you about making the trek. How did you arrange it? Who did you talk to? And how did you know that you'd be well received there?
Well, Frank and I actually were at the trial of the Chicago 8. A message came from Vietnam saying that the Vietnamese would like to meet with the conspirators, the quote-unquote conspirators. They could not go because it would violate the terms of their bail. So Frank and I ended up going to meet with the Vietnamese in a conference in Montreal, and that was the beginning of what, for me, was called people-to-people diplomacy. And as a result of that meeting and meetings in various other capitals around the world, at the request of the Vietnamese, we organized a Yippie women's trip to Vietnam. And this took place in late May, early June, actually just after the Kent State shootings in 1970. And it was not simply get on a plane. I believe we went from New York to Paris, Paris to Moscow, where we were stuck for 3 weeks because the visas hadn't come through. But we did manage to meet a lot of Russian hippies who would spoke English. And I said to them, how come you speak such good English? And they said, we listen Credence Clearwater. We learn English from Credence Clearwater. And so then after we got the visas, we went, I believe, from Moscow to Samarkand, to Karachi, to Delhi. And then eventually we ended up on a two-prop plane, an Aeroflot plane that was so small that when the Russian stewardess, who was, shall we say, a hefty woman, walked down the aisle, I could feel the plane like going from side to side. And then we landed in Hanoi, and we were met by representatives of what was called at the time the Committee for Solidarity with the American People. We were absolutely warmly welcomed. We traveled around the country in the north. We got as far as where we could hear the sounds of gunfire from the demilitarized zone, but we didn't get there. But we were welcomed in an amazingly warm way by all the Vietnamese we met.
I think one of the contributions that this book makes to understanding both the present and the past is that a lot of attention in many Americans, whatever they thought about the war then or now, give a lot of credit to the Vietnamese military and to General Giap. What doesn't get so much attention, except in our book, is that they also had a diplomatic strategy. And that diplomatic strategy involved distinguishing between the people of the United States and the government of the United States. So this idea of cultivating contacts, 200 people, give or take, went to Vietnam, but at least hundreds, if not thousands of others, went to meetings in Montreal, in Paris, in Vancouver. And this was a part of a global strategy of the Vietnamese in a time of many anti-colonial uprisings in Africa, Latin America, and in Asia to help people all around the world understand what the war was about from the Vietnamese point of view.
Frank and Judy Gumbo with the book The People Make the Peace. This is InDeep's Best of 2015 review. Next, modern musical theater. I'm Angie Coiro.
They fought the longest war in American history. They fought the longest war in American history. In 1965, Vietnam seemed like just another foreign war. But it wasn't. It was different in many ways, and so were those who did the fighting. In World War II, the average age of the combat soldier was 26. In Vietnam, he was 19. 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 Every day. 19.
U.S. military spokesman said today more than 700 enemy troops were killed last week in that sensitive border area. Throughout all of South Vietnam, the enemy lost a total of 2,689 soldiers.
I'm Angie Coiro with In Deep. We're celebrating the debut of our syndicated show on KALW. In 2015, In Deep covered theater events throughout the Bay Area. Two of the most striking were Ghost Quartet at the Curran in San Francisco and Fire on the Mountain from TheaterWorks Silicon Valley. Ghost Quartet was a bit hard to summarize, so I asked creator and performer Dave Malloy if he had an elevator speech summary.
So it is this this theatrical presentation of a concept album. So we kind of sing, I think it's like 23 songs total. And the 23 songs are all connected thematically. They all have to do with, you know, ghosts and death and the afterlife in some kind of way. And then woven throughout these songs, there are kind of four main stories. So one story is kind of just like a minor little story about Scheherazade and her sister and the Shah. And then there's also a piano player there trying to invoke the ghost of Thelonious Monk. The second story is kind of based on a bunch of grim fairy tales. So that's kind of a more, there's a bear and the bear sends Rose Red out on a quest to find some things. And then there's a third story that's very loosely based on Edgar Allan Poe's The Fall of the House of Usher. Mm-hmm. And then the fourth story is a contemporary story, which is inspired by a photograph that was run on the New York Post of a person about to be hit by a subway train. So a photographer just happened to be there, and this person pushed someone in front of a train, and this photographer grabbed this shot right before, seconds before this person was killed. So there's a story about that as well. But the four stories all kind of interweave inside of each other, and they're all kind of contained in each other in weird ways. And then the four of us basically play four reincarnations of these characters. So all of us, kind of exist in all four of these time periods.
I think the best way to give our radio audience a feel for this is for them to hear a cut from a song called Photograph. And I want to let our listeners know that, normally you play 30 seconds or so. I want you to really sit and listen to this with your eyes closed, unless you're in the car. Please don't do that. just give a listen to about 2 minutes of this song. It captures so much of the show. This is Photograph from Ghost Quartet.
She threw it to the ground, disgusted by what she had done.
What had she done?
She had taken a photograph of something inappropriate, or rather, a photograph at an inappropriate time, or rather, a photograph instead of being a hero.
If that doesn't get people interested, nothing would.
Sure.
Can I just say how much music is integrated into you that even though this is your music and you've heard it 1,000 times, your body was kind of reacting to it
sure.
We listened to it?
Yeah. Well, it's always, and so Gelsey Bell is the lead vocalist on
this.
And
voice.
Just listening to her sing, I can do that all day.
Yeah. Who I thought of when I was listening to her was Kate Bush.
Mm-hmm. She's a big Kate Bush fan. So.
Is she?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
The range, her range is amazing.
I asked Dave about the cast drinking and distributing whiskey during the show and the references to drinking sprinkled throughout.
Every reference to alcohol, from the time it first came through the audience to the time that they'd see the singers taking a drink, it was always funny.
Mm.
Why is alcohol funny?
I think in the show we kind of ride a line with it. So yeah, all the stories have alcohol involved in some way. And for the most part, it's, we talk about it in a funny way, but the actual underlying story is a little darker. You know, it's a lot of people who are alcoholics and who are like, you know, who end up murdering people or doing terrible things while they're drunk. Right. That's a very subtle through line, but we were kind of interested in playing with that and like having people be complicit in the storytelling in some way too. Like if they're drinking and they're hearing about someone who is an alcoholic, like what that does to you as you're drinking was an interesting thing for us.
Aside from being a musical, Fire on the Mountain could not have less in common with Ghost Quartet. It was at once a celebration of American roots music and a brutal history of Appalachian life, mining, black lung, land swindles, and the fight for labor rights. Featured performer David Lutkin was a gift to our show. He brought us not just tales from the stage, but his guitar and stories from his own North Carolina childhood. We talked about company stores, which kept the miners in constant debt.
These people had to shop at the company store with scrip, not with real money. And if they were found shopping somewhere else, they could be fired.
Well, I think that probably kind of varied from town to town and company to company and situation to situation. Of course, it would have been quite an effort to make it anywhere else except for the holler where you were to try to buy your supplies from somebody else. You'd have had to make a heck of a trip. But these companies had these things set up in a way, it's a little bit like indentured servitude, you know, that people began their careers in debt. At the same time, mining, of course, is an alternative in the 19-teens and 20s and 30s to farming. But one thing about mining that was very different from farming is that my family was in the farming business, is that mining presented an instant gratification, that you went to work and you came out of the hole and you got the money and you went home, or the scrip or whatever it was, whereas farming is not like that at all. You go to work, you work all day, you go home and you eat whatever's there, and you don't get any money for months and months and months and months and months. So the alternative, which became a trap for a lot of people, was I'll go work in the mine and they give me money right away.
One of the things I haven't mentioned yet is the striking use of authentic pictures from the time. And they range from, you know, kids just hanging out to kids gritty coming out of the mine. The miners themselves in various stages, from looking like they're hanging out to obviously quite ill. The dialogue between the songs is authentic tales from the mines.
That's right. Randy Myler and Dan Wheatman, the two fellows who put all of this together. Randy conducted interviews with several people to make the dialogue for a family, a mother and daughter and son, but they also are sort of father and son and grandmother and everybody, you know, and not just in the Appalachian sense. But at any rate, the dialogue is from actual interviews, and the pictures, the images, are quite beautiful and evocative of many things. They're pictures from probably about at least 75 years worth of Appalachia, all the way from World War I up to the strikes in the 1970s against Duke Power, folks with the black lung, and some unbelievable landscape shots of mountaintop removal. Mining.
Oh, yeah, just sludge where there used to be something living. Yeah.
It's incredible.
There's an old-timey feel. Probably, you know, it's roots music, American music, and it feels safely in the past. So when the picture comes up of the strikers in the 1970s, you realize how recent this was. You realize how badly people were paid, how they were dying, how they got, and there's a really, I'd almost call it a treacherous part of the play where there are people sealed in the mine dying, and the way that's depicted is heartrending. It's not that far in the past.
No, that's true. That particular song, Shut Up in the Mines of Coal Creek, has an interesting history to it. I learned that song when I was pretty young, 8 or 10 years old, I guess. It actually was a poem that had been around for a while from a cave-in in the 1920s, where when the rescuers finally made it to this pocket where these men were, they were all dead. But while they had been in there, one of them had written this poem, and he had it on him. So they decided to put it to music and recorded it. And it's as you say, it is quite an affecting thing.
Can you give us some of those lyrics?
Well, it starts off, says, "Shut up in the mines of Coal Creek. We know that we must die. But if we trust in Jesus, to heaven our soul shall fly." And he goes on and talks about their food's running out and all kind of terrible things. As I say, he apparently finished up, I guess it's three or four verses of it, and before he died, and that's what they found.
Wow. There is another change in the tenor of the music when the idea of unionizing comes in. When you start to see the rage, when people realize the injustice of how they're being treated, we've come to get to know these people as strong and, you know, happy and cheerful in the face of adversity, and all of a sudden they're really pissed off.
That in the show is precipitous. But in reality, I think it went over a longer period of time and is in reality even more acrimonious than it is in the show, because, of course, there's a long history of labor and management disputes that turned quite violent, and many people died in those as well. Aunt Molly Jackson and things that happened at Matewan and all those kinds of things depicted in this show are a good summation of some of those things, but they pale in comparison to some of the pitched battles that actually took place.
One of the things that I was pleased to find happening in myself as I was watching this was confronting some of the prejudices that I have, and from discussion I know other people have. They hear a Southern accent or they hear quaint American music, and they assume a lower IQ or a silliness. And finally, someone on stage acknowledged that and said, "We're known for the Beverly Hillbillies. No wonder nobody respects us."
Well, that's the story of my life. it is true, though, that a lot of times this music, because it is very simple and straightforward, is assumed not to be very complex or nuanced in its meaning or its usage. And it is things like this very show, Fire on the Mountain, that I think show a lot of its dimension.
Mm-hmm. I have some questions from the audience for you. And one person notes that the story seems very personal to you and wants to know what your background is that you bring to this role.
Let's see. I suppose the main reason that it's personal to me is, once again, is because of the music. I mean, that's what I've done ever since I was about 7 years old, when somebody handed me a mandolin. The other connection of having spent my summers in North Carolina as a child, that's where some of this very music came to me. I remember at the age of about 9 or 10, an old guy who used to show us boys how to whittle and make things out of wood, and his name was Edsel Martin. And he was a nice old guy from Swannanoa, North Carolina. And he had a wooden leg that he had made himself, of course. He taught us a lot of old songs, and we all together made a dulcimer with him. He was a very funny old guy, and he would get finished with his whittling project or whatever it was, and he would say, "All right, boys, it's time for lunch." And he would stick his knife in his leg just to be funny, you know, and we all thought that was great. But he was quite a character, and there are a lot of characters in that part of the world, and I think a lot of that is reflected in the music, and so it is personal for me because of my connection to that. Another guy that I admired greatly when I was very small was a fellow named Bascom Lamar Lunsford, who was another old guy from North Carolina who founded the Asheville Folk Festival back in 19-something back there. And he was quite a guy and very funny and very, very, very old when I was little. And that's actually some of the a cappella songs that Molly is singing. I used to hear some of those tunes during the Asheville Folk Festival when the little old ladies would get up and sing these songs and go out and open wide, no teeth, and just start singing Barbara Allen or whatever it was. And it was beautiful, and they were amazing performers. And that has been a connection that I didn't really understand when I was 8, but I understand it better now that those were the people. You know, it's only a couple of generations back with those kind of folks to the tap root of this kind of roots music.
Molly, in an interview, made a distinction that I had not heard before. The distinction between roots music, which is what we're hearing on stage here, and bluegrass music. She said that bluegrass is a more recent development?
Yeah, so bluegrass is sort of like the Appalachian equivalent of jazz, I guess, is that it's kind of an amalgamation of a bunch of things. My grandfather in the 19-teens and the 1920s, one grandfather had to do with booking bands at an old place in Mississippi called Allison's Wells, which was a resort. And he booked acts to play there, both black and white. And my other grandfather was in the radio business. And he had live performers on the radio all the time, and one band called the Leak County Revelers. But most of those kinds of folks in the teens and the 20s, they were kind of homemade people, and they had a couple of guys who really could play, you know, or play the fiddle or whatever it was, or really could sing. And just gradually, as that grew and grew in the Appalachian Mountains, these instrumentalists who were the just like jazz musicians who were riffing and playing on these same old melodies that they did again and again, and they speeded it up, and you had bluegrass. That's sort of how it works, in my mind anyway, and that they kind of, the musicians themselves, invented this new style.
I didn't tell you I was going to ask you this, but I enjoyed you so much playing us into this segment. I'd like you to play us out of this segment. Do you have another song you might be able to present us with?
Okay. Well, let's see.
And we can edit out any stuttering, so don't worry about that.
Well, I'll tell you, this is another song that I do in the show. This will be good. I'm sorry, I'm having to think on my seat here. So, this is a tune by John Prine. When I was a boy, my family would travel down to western Kentucky where my parents were born. There's a backwards old town that is often remembered so many times that my memories are worn. Daddy, won't you take me back to Muhlenberg County, down by the Green River where paradise lay? I'm sorry, my son, but you're too late in asking. Mr. Peabody's coal train done hauled it away. The coal company came with the world's largest shovel. They tortured the timber and they stripped all the land. Dug for their coal till the land was forsaken. They wrote it all down as the progress of man. Daddy, won't you take me back to Muhlenberg County, down by the Green River where paradise lay? Sorry, my son, but you're too late in asking. Mr. Peabody's coal train done hauled it away. When I die, let my ashes float down the Green River. Let my soul roll on up to the Rochester Dam. I'll be halfway to heaven with paradise awaiting, just 5 miles away from wherever I am. Daddy, won't you take me back to Muhlenberg County, down by the Green River where paradise lay? Sorry, my son, but you're too late in asking. Mr. Peabody's coal train done hauled it away.
And that's a wrap on Indeep's Best Interviews of 2015. You can find these conversations in their entirety at indeepradio.com. Tomorrow, at Kepler's in Menlo Park, we'll talk to historian Harvey Schwartz about his new book, Building the Golden Gate Bridge, a collection of memories from the laborers who actually did build that iconic span. Seats are free, as always, but we do appreciate reservations. You can visit keplers.com for those. We're back here on KALW next Tuesday at 9 p.m. Join us then. I'm Angie Coyrow.